Fair warning, this show contains strong language and adult themes from time to time. Sorry, Jerry can't help it.
Sick Boy Wolfgang Productions presents The Offering with Jerry Horror. A deep dive into the history of film and its filmmakers. Mostly horror, always genre.
Now, the most definitive account of the films made by the most infamous and influential studios of the 1980s, Canon Films. The Canon Film Guide Volumes 1 and 2 gives you the true stories from the people who made them, and truth is stranger than fiction. From American ninjas to masters of the universe, from Charles Bronson to Chuck Norris, from Bloodsport to Texas Chainsaw 2, take it over the top on your Superman 4 quest for peace. These books have got it all, folks. A passionate journey through the highs and lows of pure 80s goodness. The Canon Film Guide illustrates all the behind-the-scenes mayhem of one of the most beloved cult movie factories of all time. We at The Offering highly recommend these books. They are essential reading for any and all film buffs. The Canon Film Guide, Volume 1 and 2, available now at Amazon, iTunes, or wherever finer books are sold. Retrosource Long Island is taking you back. Take a trip back in time with their custom-built store paying tribute to the best decades of all time, the 80s and the 90s. They have a massive collection of video games to choose from, spanning from Atari 2600 to Nintendo Switch, not to mention a large selection of toys, plushies, art, collectibles, board games, and so much more. They've got a friendly and quirky staff that loves to talk to you all about your favorite movies, cartoons, and TV shows that you grew up with. Check out their funny skits on their Instagram at RetrosourceLI. Do you love E.T., Thundercats, Back to the Future, Masters of the Universe, RoboCop, Street Fighter, Knight Rider, Ninja Turtles, Pokemon, Power Rangers? Yeah, man, RetroSource has got you covered. Take a photo in their Saved by the Bell high school locker display. It's totally mint. Spend hours playing arcade games while getting a sugar rush from vintage candy and soda. It's gnarly, buddy. Located at 1075 Portion Road in Farmingville, New York, RetroSource, Long Island's most radical shopping experience.
Listeners and fans of The Offering can get their hands on their very own The Offering with Jerry Horror merch, now only at Tee Public. Find your own fresh The Offering with Jerry Horror high-quality merchandise, including t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, long sleeves, stickers, and mugs. Just like the show, we've got gear that's mostly horror, always genre. The Offering with Jerry Horror Tee Public Store has everything you need to represent your favorite podcast. Folks, head on over to teepublic.com right now and pick up your very own Offering Tee today. Welcome to The Offering with Jerry Horror, the show where we can have a quiet and frank discussion as adults about the things that matter to me, or at least that I think matter to me. Please take a moment to subscribe to our show wherever you get fine podcasts, and hey, stay up to date on future episodes. Coming up, an Oscar-winning franchise that burned in development hell for over two decades. Ridley Scott and Arnold Schwarzenegger dropped out of this project in the late 90s. An unconventional star and director attempting to start a new franchise. This movie was a surprise summer blockbuster that made a ton of money, but there never was a sequel. This week on The Offering, take your stinking paws off of me, you damn dirty ape. Ladies and gentlemen, friends beyond the binary, it's me, Jerry Horror, and you are listening to The Offering, the most powerful podcast on all of every platform known to man. Podcasts are falling apart, kids. Stitcher just got bought by SiriusXM. Basically, SiriusXM bought their library. You know, like, how did this get made? A lot of the Earwolf stuff. And they're going to turn that library, cannibalize it, so you'll pay for SiriusXM to hear podcasts that I listened to 5 years ago. It is what it is. It's all content. I know we talk about that. Patrick Willems had a great video on YouTube, an essay that was all about what is content and where does it come from? Well, we know where it comes from. We're still in the midst of this SAG strike right now, as well as the WGA, the writers.
And there's been a pause on content, and I got news for you. It's going to start running out. Everything from Deadpool 3 to Cobra Kai was supposed to start shooting now, and it's not happening. Even tomorrow, if the strike ends tomorrow, and I hope that by the time you're listening to this that it's over, but if it happened tomorrow, it would still take a few months to get films and television back into production, because you got all the pre-production. And not only that, if we change all the deals monetarily as far as what people are getting for residuals, lawyers have to eke all that out and make sure that the contracts are, all that stuff has to be rewritten, because it has to be now, whatever they're going to give them has to be baked into this new contract. So yeah, there's a lot of shit going on, and it has been a very cruel summer to a lot of people in the arts. You have to realize there's a lot of people who just work in the commercial field. They work in different aspects of the entertainment industry. People forget about the below the line people, the gaffers, the crews that run everything, like the union guys, everybody that's contributing to these projects. They're out of work too. They're not doing anything because nothing can get done. So I hope, I pray that cooler heads prevail. We can pay the fucking writers, because that's what this is also about. Pay the fucking writers. I'm sorry, I gotta say it. I hope your mom's not listening again to this podcast. It's like every time you try to masturbate, your mom walks in there. You're like, okay, I've got my lube. She's like, Gerald, do you know where my socks are? Why is my mother asking for my socks? Jesus, that's weird, right? But every time, I swear to God, I got it really quick. When I was a kid, I wasn't a kid, I was a teenager. Every time that I tried to get amorous, I don't even know how you say it, it's fine. Whenever I was trying to get busy with my girlfriend, my little brother would walk in. And one time, we were trying something new. It's called anal. And my little brother walked in, and I'm sure that he is triggered and somehow paralyzed with fear for years, thinking about seeing my big husky behind. It is what it is. Look, it's trauma, folks. Everything's about trauma. They made that last Halloween trilogy. It was about trauma. Everything in Halloween is about trauma. You got to understand what they're going. See, Euphoria is about the characters and their trauma. I'll tell you about trauma. You want to know about trauma? I'm going to tell you. So my friends, they did this public access. It was Slacker TV. It's a TV show that aired public access in New York. And they eventually decided that they were going to do a finale. And, I mean, if you're going to do a finale, you got to call Jerry Hara. Because I was going to play the hero. It was very much like Time Cop, the film with Jean-Claude Van Damme. And we're doing this finale, and it's bigger than anything they've done. There's a lot of special effects. There's a lot of money being put into production. It's the first time that, you know, it's like we've graduated. Like, this is a feature film in comparison to what the show was. And the show started off as like skits. It was more topical. And then eventually it develops into these storylines, and it becomes more thematic. And they're using influences from movies that were popular at the time. So they were bringing this to a close, and we needed to have some action. We needed to have some different things that were going on, because this is like a sci-fi type of thriller as their series finale. Someone came up with the brilliant idea that we should go to the local train station, which is the Ronkonkoma station, and we should do some chase sequences, some face-offs, do some like John Woo style, you know, gun battles and stuff. It was me, it's producer Pete, a couple of our other friends, some guy that I worked with at Trader Joe's, who I think already had like two strikes and he got in a lot of trouble. And I don't remember his name, but yo, I'm sorry for all the bad shit that the Slack Pack brought on you. It wasn't me, it was the Slack Pack. They're crazy, fucking criminals. So long story short, Sean, our friend, he's playing this bad guy, and he has this big bouffant James Brown wig on. He's got this red like vinyl jacket. He's got a ridiculous like goatee, because he's playing the evil version of himself from another timeline. He looks juicy. He's very like, he's, if you were playing like Double Dragon and there was a guy smoking a cigarette on a barrel while you're fighting, like that's who Sean looked like. So he's the most suspect looking man. He's got metal hands. Oh, it was a train wreck. Look up Slack Pack Endgame on YouTube. Oh boy, are you in for a treat, folks. So we're shooting this movie. We're doing stuff where we're using flints. We're heating them up and making sparks. And we're running around and yelling at each other and all this shit. Now, don't forget, this is like early aughts. It's like, what, 2003 or so? And this is post 9/11. So, Pete, everybody's kind of in different areas. And this DT undercover rolls up on Pete. And he's like, oh, you guys got guns? Those are nice guns. And he's like, yeah, I got one too. And he like flashes his 9mm. And then they're like, okay, is this guy a crazy person? He's going to shoot us? Or this is actually a fucking cop. So somehow, unbeknownst to us, because we're fucking morons and we're so enraptured by what we're doing, and that's the joy of filmmaking, that's the joy of creating, that like 20 or 30 of Suffolk's finest had rolled up on us. And they came out with guns drawn, and I was scared. I didn't shit my pants or piss myself, but I was like, this is not good. And I'm saying to myself, what did we do? Like, what did we do that was so wrong? And I guess in a post 9/11 world, you couldn't run around with fake guns and do what we were doing. We ended up having to go to court for this. We got a summons for it. And luckily, through my Academy Award winning admission, I got everybody out of trouble. That's not actually what happened, but I like to believe it is. The judge asked me, he says, what are you? He's like, are you a filmmaker? And I'm like, I'm an actor, like John Lovitz. And yeah, we got out scot-free. And I think we went to Applebee's or Chili's. We went to Chili's afterwards. That other dude who helped us from Trader Joe's, I think he went to jail. I don't know. I'm so sorry. I'm not sorry. But that's, I guess, long story short, you can't do that at the train station. there's things you can do and there's things you can't do at the train station. Don't get caught pissing, don't be fucking, and definitely do not make the series finale of a long-running comedy series at the train station. If you like stories like this, I got this book coming out, man, and it's all about the 90s and all the crazy wavy stuff we used to get into. Also with some sweet memories, some bittersweet memories. I've talked about it before, but I had to see Regarding Henry instead of Point Break. And it was very formative. Really, you know, my father always said, yeah, you have to learn to live with disappointment because it builds character. I guess he's right. So we needed to get guns pulled on us at the fucking train station, right? I guess it kept us out of doing crazier things, you know, like hanging on the sides of trains and shooting it and... We would never do that. We're way, way too big of pussies to do that. But hey, look, this is what happens. We got the book coming out. This is this season. What a great season. So great. The bangers. We had Cobra, Last Action Hero. What else do we have? Did we have other movies? There's other movies. I'm not going to say what they are. But you've listened to the other episodes and you know they're good. You know this is the best damn podcast in the world. Easily. So if you are so inclined to, maybe you write a review. You get out there. You say, I'm going to write a review for The Offering. It's the greatest show I've ever seen. Maybe you write a movie question or something like of that nature that'll stump me. It's like, oh, Jerry will never get this. I'll get it because I'm a fucking machine, okay? You can't stump the stumper. Doesn't make any sense. Who's the stumper? Look, we got a great show for you today. Ooh, man, this is something I've been waiting for. Donnie Wahlberg's been waiting for this one too. He's like, oh, I fucking hope he gives it real bad to Mark. You know, Mark's got a lot of good stuff in his life and sometimes he needs to be taken down a peg. So Donnie Wahlberg will be calling in later. Hey, I'm at Jerry Hara on all the social medias, TikTok, Threads, Instagram, X, all that good stuff, baby. You know where to get at me. It's at Jerry Hara. You know what? I'm so excited right now. Just being thought that I might have been murdered at that train station that day. So I got a lot of energy and I want to put it into this episode. I want to give it to you the hard way. So enough is enough. Let's get down to business. I ain't got time to fuck around. Who is this? It's incredible. Everybody's doing their thing in this movie. Everybody's really trying to act through the makeup. And Michael Clark Duncan, rest in peace, fantastic in this movie. Tim Roth, Paul Giamatti, everybody just really trying to elevate this material as best as they know possible. The film in question is 2001's Planet of the Apes. This is the story of a project that lingered in development hell for almost three decades. Some executives during this era would tell you that a Planet of the Apes remake would never happen. It'll never get made.
One day they'll tell a story, and some will say it was just a fairy tale about a human who came from the stars and changed our world.
Freedom is history.
Where am I? What is this place?
Get them out and get them clean!
Brutality is law.
Rise when your master enters.
The powerful rule by fear.
Next you'll be telling us these beasts have a soul.
Is there a soul in there?
It's disgusting the way we treat humans.
How the hell did they get like this?
What other way would they be?
If they see you on the street, they kill you on sight.
You stay here, you're already dead.
Which tribe are you from?
United States Air Force. I'm going back. Bye.
Some humans have escaped.
Is there another way out of the city?
I can show you the way.
They travel with apes.
Declare martial law. We underestimate this human.
The hell are they?
The story is spreading through the villages. They all want to see this human who defies the apes.
Full division! Full battle ready!
It's over. There's no help coming.
You came.
Sound the call to march!
Get me the spaceman.
Bow your head!
I think it's fair to call this hostile territory.
This is probably one of the greatest production hell stories because it spans so much time. The one that would be second to this would be Freddy vs. Jason, which languished for almost 20 years. And that, oof, Jesus, I don't even want to get into that. You know, there's been books written on it. It's insane. I want to just pose a question to everybody. All right, let's time out for a second here. Is this the first movie where Tim Burton kind of falls off? Here, let me show you the roadmap of Tim Burton. My man starts with Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and that's strong. That's a strong debut feature. Then he does Beetlejuice, previous episode. Check it out. Batman, Edward Scissorhands, Batman Returns, The Nightmare Before Christmas, Ed Wood, which arguably is one of my favorite top five films on any given day, along with RoboCop, Boogie Nights, I'm going to say it, Kickboxer, and Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween. Then he does Mars Attacks, and then Planet of the Apes. Mars Attacks kind of underperformed because it came out that summer with Independence Day, and people were kind of confused. They thought that Mars Attacks would be like a straight, kind of like goofy horror movie, and it wasn't. It was more like a satire on many different films. I'll call Mars Attacks a ding. It's not a bad movie, but it's definitely a ding. I would say the dong is Planet of the Apes, right? That's really where he falls off. After all, on Tim Burton's behalf, he meets his partner, Helena Bonham Carter. He ends up divorcing his wife of over a decade, Lisa Marie. And you've seen Lisa Marie is in everything from Beetlejuice. She's in every movie in some form or fashion until Planet of the Apes. So we need to get into this. When was the last time they actually made a Planet of the Apes movie? Well, there was 1973's Battle for the Planet of the Apes. That was kind of the conclusion of the five film series, which over time just became cheaper and cheaper. Like, the first movie wins an Oscar. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a good movie. And they just keep going with the series. And each movie is like the law of diminishing returns. It's kind of like the Friday the 13th effect, where it's like, could we make this one just a little cheaper? Okay. It did pretty good. I'll tell you what. We'll make another one. Okay. Can we make it just a little cheaper? A little cheaper than we did. Okay, fine. By the time you get to Battle the Planet of the Apes, it's not even real makeup. There's people just wearing ape masks because they don't want to spend the money Battle for the Planet of the Apes is the culmination of the five films, and it's supposed to be like the big war. It's like Return of the King. It's just like the same five guys in ape costumes. Like, they try to put like a bunch of extras, and then behind them will be more apes, but they'll just be guys in cheap Halloween masks. Literally, they wore the Don Post masks that were sold to kids. I don't know. I guess everything comes full circle one way or the other. In 1974, we would see 14 one-hour episodes of, and it was an hour-long show, Planet of the Apes. And they got Roddy McDowall to do the show. And again, it was done cheap. You know, the apes in the background were wearing the Halloween masks. They did 14 episodes. It lasted one season. People were just, by this time, they're just out of the apes. And then the final, the death knell of this whole series in its original incarnation is Return to the Planet of the Apes, which is a 1975 animated television show. It aired on Nickelodeon when I was a kid in reruns. This was in 1975 to 1976, running a paltry 13 episodes. And that's it. They even pull it out of syndication. So by 76, Apes is done. There is really no presence other than a couple of toys made by Mego and some other peripheral things like Viewmaster. It's dead. It's done. It would take 25 years, a quarter of a century, to bring the apes back to the silver screen. The brand was cold. People were burnt out. We got five apes movies, and these were the days where you didn't get that. The closest thing that we had gotten was maybe James Bond or the Universal Monsters. Five movies in such a short span of time, you burn people out. You think about it. Imagine releasing five Apes movies now. They did three. They made a trilogy, and now they've got another one coming out. It was supposedly in pre-production before this whole strike started. What started as an Oscar-nominated film that had depth, it had groundbreaking special effects, an incredible score. The original score for Planet of the Apes is a masterpiece. It's essentially now a joke, and it's less than 7 years later, and everybody's just burnt out on this. So what happens during this 25-year hiatus? In the 70s, it sits cold. Nobody wants to go near it. In the early 80s, it's kicked around. It's one of those things where you have a bunch of executives at Fox. It's even worse now with all the intellectual properties, but it's kind of like having a box of toys and you dump the toys out on the table and you say, what do we got to work with here? Who's our bad guy out of these action figures? Who's our good guy? Or what do we have that's interesting? Would this guy be in his own movie? The whole, you know, it's like me holding up an action figure. You know, can we make a movie about this guy? So they don't know what to do with it. They really don't. And I think because of what was starting to go on with crass commercialism and other things, you've got a lot of high concept movies. You got stuff like Tron. You got The Thing. You got Ghostbusters. People are really not interested in making another Apes project. They think it's something that's just from their childhood. They had an action figure of it, and it'll lay dead and buried. People, I tell them all the time, if you think something can get remade, if you liked something, like producer Pete and I were at Retrosource, we were watching, we're over there watching what? Silverhawks. First off, Super 7, the toy makers, they brought back Silverhawks, and they've been selling. They've been doing these four-figure waves, and they've been selling. And it's only a matter of time before someone says, hey, you know, Silverhawks would be good as a one-hour drama on Peacock. You don't think it'll happen? They made Twisted Metal. I've seen it. It's okay. It's fine. Anthony Mackie's charming. I didn't have that on my bingo card, as usual. I didn't see them making something about a 25-year-old PlayStation game, but here we are. And it's probably going to get a second season if the strike ever ends. Nothing's getting a new season if it doesn't end. Now, this is not the cartoon. This is Return to the Planet of the Apes. This is the 1988 screenplay and version. By September 1988, it was reported that Planet of the Apes, the final battle, would be filmed following the next year with Adam Rifkin writing and directing. It was the story of a child of Cornelius' son, and Taylor's daughter, the characters originally played by Roddy McDowall and Charlton Heston. So it's concluding, it's carrying over. This is the new generation. Because, hey, at this time we were getting Star Trek, the new generation. Why can't we do it with the apes? right? We do something that it's still a part of the other movies. You can go back and watch them and it ties into this. They need a star attached in order to make this version of the film work. So they're like, okay, we like the idea of bringing back the apes, but unless you can get a star attached, we're really not interested. So the two front runners for this version of the movie was Tom Cruise and Charlie Sheen. Those were the choices as the lead. Rick Baker was hired to oversee the makeup and designs. Danny Elfman was going to do the score. This version of the movie, Apes Final Battle, it had so many different working titles. It's basically Ben-Hur. It's about a young human slave that looks to free himself and his people. The humans are fighting each other like gladiators for the apes' entertainment. And the apes have gotten to a point in their society where they're like Rome, okay? Everything's about to come apart. It's the decadence, and they've gotten a little too foolish and selfish, and this is how their culture is about to completely fall apart. Now, James Cameron was going to produce this, but ultimately he goes off and starts to do The Abyss, and then he does Terminator 2 after that. John Landis tried to save the picture as a primary investor. He said, look, I really loved Apes as a kid, and I'll put in some money just to keep the project turning. Ultimately, what people said about this script, the 88 script, was it's overtly dramatic, it's way too talky, people are just not going to go and see this Ben-Hur inspired story. And I think, you know, years later you get Gladiator and people seem to like that. I think if you could have worked that aspect, it might have come to fruition and worked on some degree, but it just didn't work. And then the other thing that would happen was Rifkin, who had written this one, he's like, listen, the story's so big, it needs to be split into multiple films because of the complex storyline. 20th Century Fox is like, look, we're looking to get one movie off the ground. You know, let's not count our eggs before they're hatched. You know, back in the old days, not everything was, wow, we're going to turn this into a franchise and also put it on television and then have a multimedia concept. There'll be news stories through social media as well as a new video game that'll be dropping for PS5 this fall. You know, like, things weren't like that. It was very, if you made a movie, maybe make a sequel. Maybe make a couple of bucks. If you get lucky, you get five Apes films. If not, you know. Hot off of a little film called JFK, in 1993, this is December 1993, Oliver Stone had signed on to be an executive producer, co-writer of a proposed new Planet of the Apes movie. Oliver Stone thinks to himself, he's like, if I get the right director attached to this, I can really cook, I can make this work. So the first guy he goes to is Sam Raimi. He approaches Sam Raimi and he's like, listen, I know you just did Darkman and I think this would be a good project for you. I think that you know, are you a fan of the apes? And obviously Raimi, he grew up, he loves the apes. He's like, yeah, of course, I would love to do it. So now he's like, all right, we got Sam Raimi. We got an okay script that Oliver Stone is kind of tooling with. He recruits Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Arnold wants in because much like everybody else who grew up, he loved those Planet of the Apes movies. The thing is, Schwarzenegger has a different vision for this. He says, listen, we need to go violent and dark. It's the only way that this will work. It needs to be more akin to like stuff I did with Conan. So in this version of the movie, Stan Winston is brought on to design the apes. And keep this in mind. Just keep in mind how we keep rotating people in and out. This version involved hyper-intelligent gorillas, and they were the ruling class. They're like these big silverback apes, and they control, they're like the Congress, the Senate, the President, they control everything. Well, get braced for this script because, man, it's wild. Schwarzenegger would have played a scientist who goes back to the Paleolithic era via a time travel device, which no one seemed to know. Like, is it a car? Is it a portal? No one, it was very nebulous. No, he'll go back in time. It'll be the Paleolithic era. It'll make sense. It'll be fine. So he goes there and he meets a tribe of Cro-Magnon men. Most of this movie is very much like The Lord of the Rings. He has to go on this quest. The apes banish him. So he works with the Cro-Magnon men, like the missing link, to help them rise up against the evil gorillas. To be perfectly honest with you, this script is online. It's the Oliver Stone one. I can't make heads or tails of it. I have no idea what's going on in this movie because you've got time travel. You've got this whole class, ruling class of apes, and then he's working with the Cro-Magnon people, but he meets a woman and she's human because you can't have a Cro-Magnon woman. You can't, because she'll be like ugly, she'll have a humpback or whatever it is. Schwarzenegger's not going to kiss her. That's not how he you know, rolls. The other problem with this Oliver Stone version that I noticed reading through it, there's a ton of Bible influence. Honestly, I know that everything from The Matrix to Man of Steel is all inspired by the Bible, but honestly, all the biblical stuff doesn't work in the screenplay whatsoever. Okay, so Raimi decides to do Army of Darkness and leaves the project. Stone is desperate to get a new director. He runs into Ridley Scott at an airport in the United Kingdom, and he says, would you want to do this? And then Ridley Scott says, yeah, okay. He's like, yeah, well, I don't know. And he says, well, I got Arnold Schwarzenegger attached. And he says, oh, he's like, I'd like to work with Schwarzenegger. You know, at that point, he had worked with Paul Verhoeven, John McTiernan, worked with a lot of good people. Everybody wanted a piece of that Arnold pie. Ultimately, the project had very little to do with the Planet of the Apes concept. As they keep bringing it forward, there's elements in this screenplay, because Ridley Scott comes in and he does a rewrite with Schwarzenegger, and his version of it is very weird. I mean, it's really out there. And a lot of the things that he comes up with for this 93 version of Planet of the Apes ends up in Prometheus. So I found that to be really interesting. Like, these ideas had been gestating and they would permutate into different things. This being, you know, Prometheus, which is in the Alien universe, but not really an Alien movie, but was just mismarketed, and it's a mess. I like Prometheus. The 3D version of Prometheus is incredible. You can score that, definitely make that happen. So, 20th Century Fox had gotten Peter Jackson to write a treatment. This is all happening like 93, 94. Now, Jackson's version was even more different and removed from what the previous two were. His version showed apes and man coexisting in modern Italy during the Renaissance. Okay. This one I read a little bit of. It was wild. It's kind of interesting, but it's really a little too much like Dune, where you have all these people. There's like ruling class, and then there's people, like the apes are trying to take over from the humans. Like, they're living in peace, but everybody's making overtures. It really comes off like Game of Thrones with apes. And you can read that screenplay. It's pretty terrible. Ultimately, though, Jackson, he writes this script and they like this script. They think it's kind of weird, but he decides to go and make Heavenly Creatures instead. So, in early 1994, like January, February, the project is completely abandoned again. So you thought, like, this is just, it could be Jason Voorhees or Freddy Krueger. This thing will not die. So in 1995, Sam Hamm, if you're familiar, he was a writer on Batman. He did a lot of stuff with Burton. He gets a crack at a script. And Home Alone and Mrs. Doubtfire director Chris Columbus, later go on to do the Harry Potter series, he stepped in to try and revive the project because he was a big fan of the apes growing up. They got Sam Hamm on board. Basically, at this point, Sam Hamm and Chris Columbus had worked together on two unproduced movies that would later get made, but very different. Columbus was originally supposed to direct a Fantastic Four movie for Fox. And they both did a script and were supposed to make Watchmen in the late 90s for Warner Brothers. This version of the movie would take more inspiration from the original source material, the actual book. Yes, Planet of the Apes is based on a book. Now, this script resembles what we would get, kind of what we would get in the 2001 version. The humans eventually make it back to Earth, only to discover a Statue of Liberty with an ape-like face. This was their big set piece. It was the Statue of Liberty as an ape, and there was going to be a big battle. That was their big set piece for this movie. Arnold Schwarzenegger remained attached to star, But over the course of summer of 1995, Ham's script failed to meet Fox's approval. They're like, just isn't right yet. Columbus drops out in late 1995 and then takes Arnold Schwarzenegger with him to make Jingle All the Way. So that's what happens to that. At one point, this film is offered to director Chuck Russell. Chuck Russell, you know, The Mask, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, did The Blob. He declines and pulls out of the project to make Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it's funny because Schwarzenegger is with Fox and he's trying to make this Planet of the Apes movie and then goes and makes two other movies with two different directors. And it's kind of brilliant. It really shows you that Arnold was a tactician. He was very sharp. Guy knew how to network. Still knows how to network. He's a genius. And truth be told, Arnold made out like a bandit. This whole development hell of the apes in the 90s, in the end, Schwarzenegger got two paychecks out of it. God bless. Okay, so there's a last-ditch effort in 1995. 20th Century Fox offers the film to Michael Bay. And Michael Bay says, okay, well, what can we do here? They basically lowball Michael Bay. They're like, we're not giving you the money that you want to make this. Bay leaves, and what does he do? He makes The Rock with Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery. And that's a great movie. It's one of Bay's best. So I think he made the right decision. Are we done yet? No, we are not done yet. But we're almost there. The film gets offered to Peter Jackson again in 98. He chooses to pursue his passion project, which is Lord of the Rings, which almost didn't get made. In fact, in 1998, Lord of the Rings came so close to being made, but for one reason or another, New Line was like, listen, the effects just aren't there. Jackson wanted to use CGI and do other things, and it would be, you know, a short number of years later and the CGI would be there. I always kind of wonder what that 98 version of Lord of the Rings would have looked like. Unfortunately, Roddy McDowall, Fright Night, Planet of the Apes, he passes away. And Jackson's interest in the project fades as well, because Roddy McDowall was his hero. And that was the whole impetus for working on this project. I want to work with McDowall. I think he's a genius. Unfortunately, it didn't come to pass. But finally, in 1999, the Hughes brothers, if you remember the Hughes brothers, we know them from hell, they get offered the project, but ultimately decide to make From Hell with Johnny Depp, because everybody, I think what it was that the Planet of the Apes property and the projects that they were trying to resurrect in the late 80s and the 90s, it was like poison. It was basically one of these things, like if you were a decent director or up and coming, you got offered Apes. Somebody, you know, it was like one of those things like, hey, you want to do Apes? And the reason being was that Fox was just desperate to get it off the ground. So it became one of those things, was like you would talk to a friend, you know, a screenwriter, and be like, hey, did you get offered Apes? And be like, yeah, I got offered Apes. And everybody's like, oh, I don't want to touch it. In late 1999, screenwriter William Broyles Jr. turns down the chance to write the script, but decided to sign on, and his quote, when I found out I could have an extensive amount of creative control. Because at this point, Fox said, whoever we give it to, let them figure it out. We're just going to market it, give them the money, get it over with. Fox projected the release date for July 2001. So Broyles sends in an outline for the screenplay, and they really like it. We've got something here. Broyles, it's looking like a go project. In February of 2000, 20th Century Fox had lured Tim Burton to direct. He was a huge fan of the material. He grew up with the cartoon and watching the TV show. He's a little older, you know. He had fun memories of watching those Apes films on Sunday mornings as a kid. They used to play them all day. They used to have the thing, the theaters, Go Ape. And you'd watch all five movies and they would just run all day and all night. Oh, God. To be alive in those days. Now, this was a big deal for executive Richard D. Zanuck, who, as we talked in a previous episode, had greenlit Xanadu, also greenlit Jaws. So let's not get, you know, there's the good and the bad. He had been a 20th Century Fox executive back in the 60s, and he greenlit the original Planet of the Apes film. And nobody wanted to do it. And Zanuck was like, we need to do this. This is a good movie. This is future thinking. We need to get kids. We need to get young people who with the counterculture movement had kind of tuned out of movies because movies weren't being made for them. You know, it's only to the 70s where we get Rocky, The French Connection, Dog Day Afternoon, The Godfather. Those are the movies that pull the young people back into theaters. But again, I digress. We take a deep breath. We move forward. Zanuck feels like this is it. My career is coming full circle, shepherding both of these science fiction films because a lot of these guys, especially producers and executives, just like athletes, they worry about their legacy. Burton was quoted as saying, "I wasn't interested in doing a remake or a sequel of the original Planet of the Apes film, but I was intrigued by the idea of revisiting that world. Like a lot of people, I was very deeply affected by the original film. I wanted to do a reimagining." Now, this quote becomes very popular in 2000. The reason is, this is the point in Hollywood history where the term reimagining becomes a big deal. Because it was the perfect spin. It's spin. It's semantics. It's how you market. You could say, well, you know what? We're going to remake Casablanca. We're going to reimagine Casablanca. Oh, that's spin. That's semantics. That's putting the right word at the right place at the right time. And it got people intrigued. It got people, did you hear they're doing? No, it's not a remake. It's a reimagining. Oh my God, what are they doing over there? What's in the water over at 20th Century Fox?
We'll be right back with more of The Offering with Jerry Horror.
You've seen these guys at all the horror shows and comic cons. Now you can get your very own Inked Up merch, the finest in embroidered horror and sci-fi themed merchandise. From Lost Boys to Street Trash, from Chopping Mall to Cobra Kai, Inked Up has the best in embroidered beanies, baseball caps, and patches. Now they've even got their own Jaws-inspired Amity Island board shorts. You gotta take a look, these things are cool. Visit their Etsy store at etsy.com/shop/inkedupmerch. Are you looking to get your own printed or embroidered merch? Inked Up has been in business for over 10 years. Whether you're looking for merch for your band or you need crew logo shirts and hats for your first film production, you need some sick looking perks for your Kickstarter project, Inked Up can accommodate your needs with their custom silkscreen printing and embroidery services. Visit inkedupmerch.com and tell them Jerry sent you. If you're anything like me, you're always on the lookout for cool, new, original gift items that you could give to your horror and genre-obsessed loved ones, or even something you could get to treat yourself. I found the perfect thing for you. Geek Emporium has custom hand-etched glass art that's the perfect gift. Believe me, when you see these glass mugs, glass jars, and original prints, you're going to want all of them for your own collection. Geek Emporium covers every genre you can imagine. Marvel, Star Wars, 80s and 90s horror. I'm looking through the website right now, geekemporium.nyc, and I can see featured. They got some gorgeous stuff from Labyrinth with Jennifer Connelly, A Nightmare Before Christmas. I see Brandon Lee's The Crow. They cover the whole genre gamut. It's incredible. I met up with these guys at Eternal Con on Long Island. I got my hands on a Sweet Texas Chainsaw Massacre Leatherface glass mug and a Freddy Krueger wooden coffin. All custom. And these are hand-drawn. They were drawing it right in front of me. So what are you waiting for? You can always check out their Etsy shop or head over to geekemporium.nyc right now and scroll through the goods. Trust me, your geek-loving loved one will thank you later. You're listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. Got a question or a story you want to share with me? It might be featured in a future episode. Email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter at jerryhara. I'm also on Instagram. You can find me there at jerryhara. Rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review in an upcoming episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to The Offering. Now back to the show. By all accounts, everyone, including Tim Burton, said that this production was rushed on all fronts. This is the problem, all right? This is the paramount problem with Planet of the Apes, and I'm going to give it to you. All the various deals that were in place, they had to be fulfilled by July 2001. Otherwise, Fox would have to fault on all these different agreements that they had signed. So it was super advantageous, especially with their European distribution, that they had this movie day and date. And this is the problem. This is like, it was a big deal in the 80s. Like, I think Batman is the first one that's like a big deal, like day and date picture, where like everything had to drop in a specific timeline in order for to create the most revenue for the film. And this happens. This is the business, you know? When you tell people, "Hey, look, I owe you money. I got to give it to you in July of 2001." So they have to guarantee all these different corporations and consortiums that had made deals with the apes. Under Burton's direction, Broyles wrote yet another draft, but his script was projected at a $200 million budget. In August 2000, 2 months before the cameras would roll, heavy rewrites start, and they were mandated by the studio. It screwed up Burton and all the actors because it was like a page one rewrite. They just redid the whole thing. Also, Burton thought he was dealing with $200 million. And they cut the budget in half. So that was the first. When they offered the film to Burton, they were basically like, "Listen, it's carte blanche. You're getting 200 mil, go crazy." And now he's being told this movie's got to be done in X amount of time, and we're gonna cut it in half. So he's kind of like, "All right, they've already gone back on their first promise, and we haven't even rolled a foot of film yet. It's bad." A battle ensued with Burton on the side of his actors, whom didn't like the direction of the new script. Paul Giamatti especially was very upset with these new scripts. Okay, so Burton wants to film the movie in October of 2000, and it gets pushed to November of 2000. They start shooting that second week of November, and the filming ends in April of 2001. Fox originally wanted completely CGI apes. Burton essentially threatens to walk off the project. He says, "It's either practical effects with Rick Baker's beautiful work, or I am not doing this." And he made the right decision, because in 2001, to create the type of characters they would have needed to done with CGI, it wasn't possible. Like, we weren't there just yet. So Burton was friends with Stan Winston and Rick Baker. Winston had prepped quite a few effects already, but ultimately, it came down to everybody agreed. They're like, Baker's designs are better than Stan Winston. So Stan Winston, unfortunately, gets pushed out. You know him. Terminator, Predator, Jurassic Park. Stan Winston was a genius. Rest in peace. On his hiring, Baker explained, "I did all the Dino De Laurentiis versions of King Kong in 1976, and I was really disappointed with my work because I wasn't able to create it as realistically as I wanted. I was rushed. I thought that apes would be a good way to make up for that." And again, the makeup is the most incredible part of this movie, but even Baker felt that he was rushed. They needed an armada. It was literally an army of practical effects people doing the makeup in this movie. Burton was more adamant that the apes should be substantially more animal-like, flying through trees, climbing walls, swinging out of windows, and going apeshit when they're angry. Sorry, I had to. I couldn't help myself. With the success of The Matrix, wire work had become hugely in fashion. And it's crazy because there's so many movies in the late 90s, post-Matrix, all the way up until the late 2010s, where they're just using wire work for no reason. It's like, everybody's flying. It's just, look, thematically, it makes sense. Like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, yes, it's a wuxi movie. They know what they're doing. That's a part of the culture and the mythology. When everybody started doing it, even old fat Steven Seagal in Exit Wounds in 2001, he does some wire work. And I'm like, how is this 6'4 big fat guy, I'm supposed to believe that he can jump upside down? I mean, when they did the wire work with Jet Li, who had done it before, like, yeah, I believe it. He's a small guy. You know, he can do all kinds of crazy, but not old big fat Steven Seagal. Anyway, because that also came out in 2001 from Warner Brothers, Exit Wounds. Do you remember that one, kids? That was the one with DMX and Steven Seagal. It's a banger. 10 out of 10. Watch it. Definite recommend. One thing for certain, 20th Century Fox needed a movie star to be attached for this film to shoot very quickly. So here's what happens. When you don't have a deal in place with an actor, they move on to other projects. And here's the other problem. You need to take whoever you can get because the cameras are about to roll. So it becomes one of these things. Previous episode, the whole Michael Beck debacle with Xanadu. Was he the right guy? Andy Gibb was probably the right guy, but cooler heads didn't prevail, and we got Michael Beck. Do you remember Michael Beck? I don't. Megaforce, anyone? Megaforce? Why is Megaforce not on streaming? Can I get a Blu-ray of Megaforce? What's going on? I'm very upset. Please, Kino Lorber, reach out to old Jerry Hara. One thing was for certain, 20th Century Fox needed a big star in order to anchor this picture. Now, who did they approach first? Nicolas Cage. He was the first choice. They said, this is the guy. But Nick Cage just was a little bit cagey and not interested in doing a franchise movie because that's how it was pitched to him. This is the beginning of a new world, a new era for the apes. And you like Charlton Heston? You get to be the Charlton Heston role. Cage passes, goes next in line, goes to Matt Damon. Matt Damon toys with the idea for a little while and ultimately just, it doesn't work out. Finally, it gets offered to Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon had told Ben Affleck that the script sucked, so he pulls out, and then Russell Crowe along with Will Smith. Russell Crowe obviously was approached. He decided to work with Ridley Scott and made Gladiator. Nobody knows whatever happened to Will Smith. He was the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He made some big movies in the 90s and then disappeared from the cultural footprint. It's a true story. The problem was with this film that shooting so quickly, they wouldn't be able to get a large star in time. However, Mark Wahlberg at that time was an unproven box office draw. He wasn't really a star. He did Boogie Nights. He did The Big Hit. He did Fear. Fear really launched him. Fear was the one where I saw that in theaters and I was like, oh my God, I'm like, this guy's, he's a star. He can act. He's got presence. Even though he's the bad guy, this is all working. Wahlberg is fresh off Three Kings and The Perfect Storm. And he's like, I need a big summer blockbuster. I need something that's going to get me out to the public in a bigger way. So he's like, this is it. This is my clearest shot at becoming a bigger global star. He wanted a franchise. In fact, and this is the crazy thing, Wahlberg backed out of a key role in a little film called Ocean's 11 to take this part. Matt Damon would replace him. Wow. So there's another timeline in the multiverse where Matt Damon is in Planet of the Apes and Wahlberg is in Ocean's 11. And you know what? I think Wahlberg would have been good. You know? The problem is like, I feel Matt Damon was more comfortable in his own skin at that point as an actor. And I think Wahlberg was still a little too green. You know, even when you watch this Planet of the Apes, you see him and it's not only does he look like he's 12, he looks like a little kid because he's so young. It just, he doesn't have the gravitas yet. He doesn't have the necessary star power or screen presence that is necessary for a big film like this. This is even crazier. This is probably my favorite part of this whole story. Wahlberg didn't even read the script. He gets offered the movie. He finds out Tim Burton's directing and he's a huge Tim Burton head. Edward Scissorhands is his favorite movie. He absolutely loves Burton. He has a 5-minute meeting on the back lot at Fox with Burton. He talked to Tim Burton. Tim was very upfront, said, this is what we're doing. Are you interested? Because Tim needs to get this movie going. It has to happen. Within 5 minutes, the decision had been made. Wahlberg was doing Apes. He told his agent, he said, this is it. However, I want one thing baked into the contract, Tim. I think the public has seen me for too long as an underwear model. That's my reputation. He did all the successful. Hey, look, he wore those Calvin Kleins. They sold a lot. They did very well. It was the same thing like Brooke Shields did for Jordache. It was an omnipresent ad campaign in the 90s. And he didn't want to be pigeonholed as the guy who's just has a six pack and he's sexy in his underwear. And who are you kidding, pal? Like, I get it. But, you know, nobody thinks you're a dummy, you know? You're just a sexy guy in briefs, Calvin Klein briefs. It's fine, you know? Why do people always think that? It's like the intelligent people are like begging, like, please take me seriously. And then the dumb people are like, please take me seriously. Everybody wants to be taken seriously. It doesn't matter, you know, like, You got a six-pack or not? It's crazy. We all want the same things, folks. Especially Donnie Wahlberg. You think Donnie, you think he asked him for a cameo? He's like, just put me in, bro. He's like, I'll be one of the apes. Nobody will even know. You don't even have to credit me, bro. So, baked into this contract, he says in the original movie, Charlton Heston wears a loincloth. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to just be a sex object put out there. I want people to know me for my acting. So, no loincloth, and his agent also put it in the contract with Fox, I will not appear shirtless in this film. This was really baked into his contract. I'm not even kidding. Tim Roth plays the villainous General Thade. It's so funny because like all of these characters had, they had coloring books, they had action figures. Does anybody, like if I asked you, like, do you remember the who played the villain General Thade? They're like, I don't know. What the fuck is that? What movie is that? They wouldn't know. I'm telling you, as good as the special effects are, the practical stuff, nobody remembers this movie. A lot of people went to go see this movie, but nobody remembers it. Now, what's crazy is everybody's making decisions now. It's a pivotal point in film history. Tim Roth had gotten the part to play Professor Snape, and he backs out of the Harry Potter movies. You know, Alan Rickman ends up taking that part. It's like the role of a lifetime for Alan Rickman. And this is just, I mean, come on, you backed out of Harry Potter. I mean, nobody knew. And it's crazy because the last guy who was on this project was going to direct Harry Potter, that's another weird coincidence. Now, originally, Gary Oldman was to play General Thade. He dropped out because 20th Century Fox refused to pay him what he wanted. Like, Oldman wanted a sizable chunk of cash, and they were just like, no, we don't think it's worth it. Helena Bonham Carter would be cast as Ari, a virtuous chimpanzee who fights for human rights. She was originally supposed to be like a princess, and Mark Wahlberg was going to rescue her, but ultimately the producers and her and Tim both agreed, like, we're not going to do that. Like, we're not going to have an ape princess, because there is some weird psychosexual shit going on in this movie. I think early into this draft, somebody had thought, and again, this was another one, as previous episodes ended, we're changing the script. I think there was supposed to be an interspecies love thing between Mark Wahlberg and Helena Bonham Carter, Ari. And I think somebody said, you know what? You do whatever you want, Mr. Burton, but Mark Wahlberg is not going to fuck an ape. You know what I'm saying? Like, in our big summer tent pole, $1 billion summer movie, you can't fuck an ape. It's just a bridge too far. There's things you can do and there's things you can't do. So Burton's wife, Lisa Marie, is actually in this movie. This is the movie where, you know, as previously mentioned, this is where Burton and Carter meet. They begin having an affair on this movie. And they're doing it behind Lisa Marie's back. She's on set. They're on set. And they're canoodling and doing whatever they're doing. And hey, Burton and Carter have been together for 20 years. I feel bad for Lisa Marie, but who knows? She could have been a lousy lay. I don't know what the story is. Somebody contact Lisa Marie and ask her. Michael Clark Duncan was cast as General Attar. Originally, Ron Perlman was supposed to take the role, but he didn't want to do all of the heavy prosthetic work that is, until his good pal Guillermo del Toro came along and said, listen, I want you to be Hellboy, but you're going to have to wear 86 pounds of makeup. You know what, though? Perlman made the right choice. The Hellboy movies are fantastic. Both of them are just great. Model Estella Warren was cast as the love interest for Mark Wahlberg. She had an action figure. I just want to note that. Nobody bought it, even though it was, for whatever reason, hot Estella Warren did not translate to 5 inches of plastic. It is what it is. But let's be honest. We always talk about this. It's like Mean Girls trying to make Fetch happen. They tried to make Estella Warren happen, and it just did not take. Previous episode, Taylor Kitsch. They tried so many times to make that kid a star. You remember when he was Gambit? Dude, he was Gambit. They were like, oh, we're gonna do a Gambit spinoff film. We're going to do a Gambit multiverse. Oh, it's going to be lovely. This is it. This is Taylor Kitsch. Household name, Gambit, Everyone knows it. Culture zeitgeist. Boom. She's terrible in this movie. Estella Warren is terrible. She's horribly miscast. She's a very pretty woman. And that's about it, kids. She has two emotions or two facial expressions. One is shocked and the other is bewildered. I don't think she was acting. I'm not even quite sure that Miss Warren knew where she was. Industry veterans in this film? It's the Chris Christopherson sans. That's not even a real word. It's Chris Christopherson. Everybody loves him. What did he do? He just did Blade, right? Dude, Blade. Come on. He's Whistler. Great movie. David Warner. You know David Warner. He was in Waxwork. He was in Star Trek multiple times. He was in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze. You guys know who David Warner is. Recently passed away. Rest in peace. And even old Charlton Heston in an uncredited cameo. Paul Giamatti rounded out the cast nicely. He absolutely loved working with Burton. He was a champion for getting a sequel made. He would practice his lines. Burton walked in on him one day and he would have the makeup applied and he would sit there with a small hand mirror and then practice for hours, figuring out how to get the most believable performance through the makeup. And I'm going to tell you, kids, if you do watch this movie, and you should, why not? What else you got going on? Smoke a joint, watch Planet of Apes 2001, talk about 9/11. It's fine. The world changed. So basically, yeah, Giamatti's performance is one of my favorite things in this movie. If you're going to watch it, that's the main attraction for me. Sorry, not sorry. The biggest problem that everybody had on this movie, the actors, the production, it was rushed. Everything was incredibly rushed. It was to the point where 20th Century Fox studio executives were coming down every day, penny pinching, micromanaging. See, like, this is, again, this is the turning point in Hollywood where things aren't movies, they're product, they're brand, they're content. And essentially, that's what happens when you have to make content. See, there's two things you can do. You can take your time or you can make it fast. Now, you got to make it fast, but the problem is when you make it fast, the quality goes down. Look, it's the diametric of business. After making Warner Brothers damn near over $1 billion during his time there, Burton had regrets. Warner had offered him the opportunity to do the $6 million man, but ultimately he chose Apes because he had more of an emotional connection to the material. He wasn't used to being under this much pressure at Warner's, at least not since Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where he didn't even think he could finish the film. At certain points, Burton would go alone off into the distance and have panic attacks, thinking that he would never get Pee-wee's Big Adventure made. But he did, and it brought him a lion's share of success and created a new style of films. Burton lobbied very hard to get Paul Reubens cast in this movie. He was originally supposed to play the Paul Giamatti role. And Universal, along with many others, wanted nothing to do with Reubens. And it's just a shame that we punished this man for no good reason. What are those weird cops doing hanging out at porno theaters? What's that about? That's even sleazier. Okay, you and McCluskey, go over to the adult bookstore and work that. Like, aren't there people being fucking murdered and raped? And you're over here arresting fucking Paul Reubens for playing with his cock? What are you supposed to do in an adult theater? That's what you're supposed to do. Rest in peace, Paul Reubens. God damn, it gets harder. I tell people this. You know, we get to an age, the millennials, the Gen Xers, everybody's dying. And we got to accept that. We got to accept that because we're at that age now where the elders start to fall off. And it sucks. Losing Paul Reubens sucks. And the way that Hollywood and this country treated him, I can never forgive. Ultimately, Planet of the Apes is shot in 80 days, which for a big budget spectacular with stunts and makeup, that's nothing. Usually these movies take like 5-6 months. Now, due to the heavy makeup, they tried not to have the actors out in the sun. And this became a big point of contention. Because if you look at the original Planet of the Apes, they do use sets, yes, but there's a lot of stuff that's being shot practically on location out in the sun. Well, here's the problem. This is heavy, heavy makeup. They needed to put this on controllable, climate-controlled sound stages. You can tell there's a couple of shots where stuff is shot outdoors, But a lot of this is just all on back lots at Fox. And it shows. It's not as bad as now they shoot everything in the volume. It's just on a fake soundstage. Kind of like green screen, blue screen in. It's all artificial and doesn't feel real. Look, you might not know. Sometimes they're inside, so that's part of the trickery. But you know what? Your brain does. Your brain picks up on these things and knows this is not outside. This is in a studio. That's fine. People were very confused about the ending. The studio was confused. The actors were... Basically, what happened was... And this is because I have to explain the ending. Because a lot of people who saw this film, they were like, what just happened? Essentially, this is it. General Thade had beat Leo back to Earth via a time warp. A lot of people didn't get that, and it pissed them off. And I'll be honest, when I first saw it, I'm like, I didn't get it. With the whole they called him Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. Okay. So Fox holds a bunch of test screenings, and they all kind of go lukewarm. They kind of do scores. They figure out what people responded to, what they didn't. You know, this is how test screenings, test marketing, it goes. It wasn't bad. People didn't dislike it, but they didn't really like it either. It was all like fives out of tens. And this is where Fox starts to get worried. They're like, wait a second, this is not working out the way we thought it would. And yeah. So Fox had signed away over $60 million. Toys, games, Oreos, whatever they had, they signed it away. Anything they could slap the apes on. So they took this money from all these different companies, and that was the agreement. The movie has to come out. Because at a certain point, Fox was like, hey, maybe we should do some reshoots and retool. Didn't have time. Just wasn't possible. They even had this weird geocaching thing. You had to buy this $200 GPS unit, and you would find props all over the world that were hidden. It never really worked. No one bought this GPS unit that was $200. This was before you had cell phones and all the cars had GPS. This was their big marketing thing. They launched this GPS product with apes to try and make it work. No one ever discovered the props. I don't even know if they were really hidden or not at this point, but no one ever found them. Some of them are supposedly still buried, and no one ever got them. Fox just plain forgot about it. If you bought this film on DVD, you would find there was like a little pamphlet inside that was an ad for the $200 GPS unit. Dude, they signed it away. They signed everything away. There were no banana flavored tie-ins. I just want to say this. When Rise of the Planet of the Apes finally came out, Denny's did banana pancakes. I do not know how you do a Planet of the Apes movie, like have banana popsicles. Something, you know what I'm saying? Something banana flavored to tie into the movie. It's money left on the table. That's why you got to hire Jerry Hara, producer Pete. We'll figure it out for you. We'll make sure there's banana tie-in products. We got you. So they want to reshoot the ending, which was a point of contention with Kevin Smith, who had written a Jay and Silent Bob comic book. And he jokingly kind of stated in the press, people thought it was serious. They took the beef serious. He's like, he stole my idea. That was the end of a Jay and Silent Bob comic. But then Kevin Smith realized he was a hack and no one would actually steal from him. I'm kidding. I love you, Kevin. Call into the show one day, prick. Yeah, basically, Burton says to Fox late in the game, he says, let's do a different ending. He's like, well, what's your idea? Okay, we're going to have Wahlberg in the spaceship and he's going to crash into Yankee Stadium. And when he gets there, it's going to be apes playing baseball and watching the game. And they're like, no, and no, because it's going to cost too much money. And we have like barely a month to get this done. There was a PlayStation game, by the way. It was mostly based on the original movie. It's not very good. Wouldn't recommend it. The film is eventually, it's time. It's time for this movie to come out, just like you would pass a bowel movement. And there's a press embargo 12 hours prior to the release. So you couldn't write a review or say anything about this movie. So if it was coming out at midnight on Thursday, you could write your article at noon. But they were trying to basically block as many media outlets as they can. They obviously have the power of Rupert Murdoch. He controls the media to a degree. So they were basically trying to keep any kind of bad press out of the headlines. Speaking of which, look, there was a whole bunch of other endings. Now, again, I just told you the Yankee Stadium one. Obviously, it was too expensive. They didn't have the time. But Tim Burton claimed the ending was not supposed to make any sense, but it was going to be more of a cliffhanger to be explained in a possible sequel. It was a reasonable cliffhanger that could be used in case 20th Century Fox or another filmmaker wanted to do another movie. So the film finally comes out on July 27th of 2001. I saw it in theaters. Producer Pete saw it. Do you remember it, Producer Pete? He remembers it, Con. I don't even know. I don't know what we were up to or what we were doing, but I saw it. We all went to theaters, and by all accounts, it was a success. It didn't feel like a Tim Burton movie. It was just this big Hollywood movie that came out and kind of was in the ether for a little while, and then it was done. So let's get into some numbers here, folks. Box office budget estimated $100 million. Opening weekend, it made $68 million. Believe it or not, the domestic gross was $180. Worldwide, $362 million. Fox was relieved. They had assumed they had a huge bomb on their hands. They were lucky to get away with their hides. And in what might be an industry first, they realized that they shouldn't hedge their bets or even bother with a sequel. And that is like the smartest thing. It's like, look, we made money. We made a lot of money off of this. We came out with the GPS thing. Nobody gave a shit. There were no banana. Look, let's just get out while the getting is good. The franchise would lay dormant until 2011 with Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I like those new movies. I like this one, Rise, with James Franco. John Lithgow's in that one. Dawn, yeah, War, they're all great. They really nailed those movies, and they were able to do the apes digitally. But that's 2011. You have 10 years of progress in CGI, you know? What's crazy is that Rise of the Planet of the Apes would release 10 years exactly to the day of Burton's version. This is kind of a weird coincidence. In a candid interview with MTV while comparing the film to Rise of the Planet of the Apes in 2011, Mark Wahlberg blamed 20th Century Fox for screwing the film up, saying, "I haven't seen it yet, but I heard it was pretty damn good." Well, ours wasn't. I mean, ours wasn't really much of anything. It is what it is. They didn't have the script right. Fox had a release date before Tim Burton had shot a foot of film. They were pushing him and pushing him, all in the wrong direction. I even said to them at one point, "You gotta let Tim do his thing." I personally ended up buying that DVD Thanksgiving at Kmart. It was a very solemn time, obviously, for the country, living in New York, obviously the tragedy on 9/11. And I think it was, especially for us here in New York, it was, you know, the threat of global terrorism. You know, we had never experienced an attack like that on American soil. And it was upsetting, you know? It was definitely hanging over all of our heads. We had some family coming over. I bought the DVD at Kmart because they were the only ones open on Thanksgiving. And what's crazy is, like, everybody was like, "Oh, Kmart, they're a bunch of scumbags for being open on Thanksgiving." And then it became like this thing in the 2000s where everybody was open on Thanksgiving and cooler heads prevailed. And like Target, they open later. It's just ridiculous. Consumerism is ridiculous. Did my family enjoy that DVD of Planet of the Apes? I don't think so. Again, it's a nothing burger of a movie. My dad liked it a lot. But again, my dad, as a kid, had gone to the movie theaters and he had gone ape. He would go with my uncle and they would watch all these Planet of the Apes movies. So, yeah. Mr. Frenari, Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes is Mr. Frenari approved. When asked if Tim Burton was interested in making a sequel, he told the press, "I'd rather jump out a window." Tim Burton and Helena Bonham Carter have yet to get married, but they've been together in a loving and committed relationship for the last 22 years. And that's probably the best thing that came out of Planet of the Apes 2001. They had this beautiful relationship, even though it might have been contemptuous considering what happened with Lisa Marie. But hey, look, love is love. The heart knows no boundaries. They've been together for a long time. It was meant to be. Let's get into some Unhinged reviews. Come on, baby. All right. Paulina from Amazon says, you should watch all movies. That's the review, that's it. You should watch all movies. Bitch, what the fuck you think I'm trying to do? That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to watch movies. I want to know what you think. Because Paulina, you telling me on this fucking Amazon thread about what you thought about Planet of the Apes. Look, that's not a review. That's not a review. That's a suggestion. Get the fuck out of here, Pauline. Okay. This is my favorite. Look, I've pulled a couple of these, but this is the only one I got. We're going to get out of here, I promise. Josh writes from Amazon. More like Marky Mark and the Planet of the Apes. Sick burn, bro. Sick. And just like Planet of the Apes, no one remembers. No one cares. It is what it is, man. Look, my friend Matty P, he always says, when we talk about this, your favorite flavor of gum will come back into style. Whatever you're into, it will come back around again. If you own an intellectual property, if you're a studio, if you're a producer, you're going to keep bringing it back. Because, like, let's say, for instance, I owned Creature of the Black Lagoon. I would bring it back every 5 to 10 years. That's what you try to do. It's a product. You're trying to make money out of it. You know, you got to think of something like Planet of the Apes, kind of like a sickly streetwalker who's trying to find Johns and bang them for money. What a comparison. Hey, look, you can find me on social media at Jerry Hara everywhere. Hey, don't forget to follow the podcast. We're on Apple. We're on Spotify. We're all over the place, baby. Follow us. Subscribe. Maybe you go on YouTube. You know, write a little review, a little something, something. Says, hey, I love the offer. Maybe you don't. That's fine. We don't care. Do whatever you want to do, man. You know what I'm saying? You want to show love, you show love. If you don't, peace be with you. I don't know what to tell you. Folks, I've been Jerry Hara. Was I Jerry Hara? He was the actor who played Jerry Hara. I'm Jerry Hara. This has been The Offering. Mostly horror, always genre. You've been listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. I'm very sorry. Produced by Pete Bune. If you have a question or a story you want to share with me, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit us up at Twitter @jerryhara or on Instagram @jerryhara. You get in the picture? Subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are provided for you and your family. I want you to enjoy. Just join us next time for another offering.
This has been a Sick Boy Wolfgang production. Thank you for listening.